Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight is a Georgia native who struggled with a speech impediment as a child. He broadcast Major League Baseball for 55 years and only missed two games. He's the only sports announcer to ever be traded for a ballplayer. In 2003, at the age of 85, he signed a 10-year contract to be the spokesman for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. We're honored to have the revered and legendary Hall of Fame announcer, Ernie Harwell, as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now, back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Ernie Harwell. Ernie, it's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Good to be here with you.
My first question is, as you come into the studio, where you used to come for decades, and you see all these buttons and everything, the changes must be enormous.
Well, there are a lot of changes, although I never came to the studio much. I was usually at the ballpark. And I would come in once in a while to do a record or something, but generally our place of work was right at the microphone at Tiger Stadium or Comerica Park.
You grew up in Georgia. You were tongue-tied. You were ridiculed often. And you've become this legendary melodic voice. How did it happen?
Well, it happened through the grace of God and also the ability of what we called an expression teacher. I think you'd call her a speech therapist now. This was depression time. My family didn't have any money, but they scraped up enough to send me to a lady named Margaret Lackland. And she had pupils who recited the poems or gave speeches or debated. And the rule in Atlanta public schools was that every pupil in the fifth and sixth grade was required once a month to either debate or declaim. So we had to learn these speeches, and we had to debate. And she turned me around, and through the grace of God, I overcame that handicap. I know a lot of people that heard me on the air later on probably still think I had that handicap, but officially I didn't. I overcame it.
Where did you get your love for baseball?
I got it from my dad. He was an invalid, but he loved the game. He had some friends who had played in the major leagues, and he grew up loving baseball, and he inculcated that love and passion for the game into me, and we enjoyed it together. It was a great thing for my life because he didn't leave a wheelchair from the time he was about 30 years old until he died at the age of 72. So it brought us together. It was a great thing.
Most every young person has dreams. During the Depression, almost nobody ever got to achieve those dreams. How did you be that rare exception?
Well, my dream really was to be a ball player, but I was one of those guys that couldn't stop a grapefruit from rolling uphill, so I had to do something else if I stayed in the game. And my brother had been a writer on the high school paper, and I had never had any experience, and I thought, well, maybe I could write and get in with a baseball crowd. So when I was in high school at the age of 16, I wrote the editor of the Sporting News, a baseball paper in St. Louis, and suggested in my youthful exuberance that I should be the Atlanta correspondent. And he didn't know I was only 16. I signed my name W. Ernest Harwell to sound a little more mature. And doggone if he didn't give me the job. And I kept writing for the Sporting News for a long, long time. And then on the strength of that, I got a job on the Atlanta Constitution. I worked on the desk, reading copy, writing headlines, doing things that nobody else wanted to do. And I did that for 6 years, and then I finally got into radio because I couldn't find a job on a newspaper. I'm a failed sports writer.
Not many people know that you telecast a couple of the Masters very early on.
Well, that's right. It was radio, but it was the Masters, and that was back in 1940. One that I did in my first Masters, and I was on the first network broadcast of the Masters, NBC, in 1942, and I came back and did it again in 1946.
How did you get into Major League Baseball?
I got into Major League Baseball in a rather goofy kind of a way. I had come back out of the Marines and began to broadcast for my local heroes, Atlanta Crackers and the Southern Association. And in 1948, Red Barber, the great announcer in Brooklyn, became ill on a trip to Pittsburgh, and his boss, Branch Rickey, felt that Red might never come back to work. He contacted the man that owned the Atlanta team, Earl Mann, said, "I'd like to have Ernie Harwell come up and replace Red Barber." And Earl said, "Well, that's fine, Mr. Rickey, but I've got Ernie Harwell under contract. And if you're really serious about this, you can have him in a trade, but you've got to send me your catcher from Montreal, Cliff Dapper." So I was traded for a minor league catcher, and that's how I got to the big leagues.
It's 1951. You get to announce, broadcast the first coast-to-coast telecast of a major sporting event. It turns out to be quite a game.
It was quite a game. Bobby Thompson hit a home run and won the pennant for the Giants, sent him into the World Series, beat the Brooklyn Dodgers in the third and final game of that series. And it was one of the most dramatic moments in sports history. Russ Hodges was my partner. We alternated on radio and TV. Russ was on the radio, and he became famous by saying, "The Giants won the pennant, the Giants won the pennant." We didn't have any replays on television. We didn't have any record at all of what I said, and only Ms. Harwell and I know what was on that afternoon.
So, you've got a number of great expressions that you're famous for. It's long gone. Where did that come from?
Well, those things just happened, Jack. I just happened to say it one time, and people began to like it a little bit, so I kept going. I did it rather late in my career. I didn't even do it as late as 87, so I did it in the last 10 or 15 years of my career. But that's the way all those expressions happen. I think if you sit down and try to contrive something and say you're going to work this out and you're going to use it, it never works that way. It has to be natural, and whatever you are, you do, and that's the way it goes.
How did you ever start when there was a foul ball in the stands? "Oh, that fella from Hamtramck caught that one."
Well, that was an accident, too. I just did it in the 60s, and then people began to ask me to have a guy from Saginaw catch one tonight, or you haven't had a lady from Windsor catch one for a while. Do that for us, and that's the way it happened.
We're talking to the legendary Ernie Harwell, and this is News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Ernie Harwell. Ernie, it's 1981, and you get elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame as the fifth baseball announcer. And during your speech, you used a couple of quotes. The first one, "I'd rather be lucky than good."
That's from Lefty Gomez, a great Yankee pitcher, and I think a lot of people have said that since then, and maybe somebody before, but he was the one that was most quoted saying, "I'd rather be lucky than good," and it's certainly true. In my career, I've been a lot luckier than I've been good, but you have to have both of those qualities, I guess, to get anywhere. You got to be lucky and good.
The second quote was, "I am a part of all that I have met."
That's from Alfred Tennyson's poem Ulysses, and the addition to that says, "All experience is an arch wherethrough gleams that untraveled world, whose margin fade forever and forever as I move. How dull it is to pause to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life." In other words, life is a little bit more than breathing.
All of us, every baseball fan in the Detroit area, has thought of when a guy takes a third strike, "He stood there like the house by the side of the road and watched that one go by." Another way you used to say, "He's guilty of excessive window shopping."
Yeah. He looked at one too many. Well, the first one really comes from a poem that I used to recite for Margaret Lackland, my speech teacher. And it's from a poem by Sam Walter Foss called The House by the Side of the Road. That's in a lot of poet anthologies, but I had to recite it, and I guess in a residual sort of way, it was in the back of my mind when I saw a guy take a call third strike.
If you could listen to one game with one announcer, who would that announcer be?
Well, that announcer would be Vin Scully, I think, of the Dodgers. And my only claim to fame, really, is that Vinny replaced me when I left the Brooklyn Dodgers after the 1949 season. He came in and began to do Brooklyn baseball in 1950, and then when the Dodgers in the mid-50s moved into California, he went then with them to be the voice of the Los Angeles Dodgers, and he's still there.
What would you tell a young person that wants to get into sports journalism today?
I'd say, number one, it's not an easy job. There's so many competent people already holding jobs, but I think you've got to have the passion for what you do. You've got to study hard, you've got to know the game, and you've got to treat people right. You've got to be prepared at all times, and you've got to take a few hard knocks along the way and have trust in yourself and just do the best you can.
You've met some interesting managers through the years. Casey Stengel, Sparky. Can you tell a story of each?
Well, Casey was the kind of a guy that went to a fractured English university, you know, whatever he said, nobody could ever figure it out. And I think he did that pretty much on purpose. And I remember one time I was covering a playoff game, and Casey was up in the PR office with his wife and Edna, and I asked him if he'd go on the air with me. I was going to do a little tape, and he said, no, I can't do it. And then we began to talk, and I think he sort of got interested, and he said, hey, let's do that tape anyway. And with Sparky, I think my favorite Sparky Anderson story is when the Tigers were on that 35-5 record. Back in 1984, they were setting all kind of records. They had the record for the most wins on the road. They were in Anaheim, and Spark and I were sitting in the breakfast room of the hotel there at Anaheim, and a guy came up, and he said, Sparky, you're the greatest I've ever known. I was a big Cincinnati fan when you had the big red machine in the 1970s and won the World Series, and you are terrific. You're my favorite guy. And he said, by the way, what are you doing these days, Sparky?
How has baseball changed from the early 40s when you got in?
Baseball's changed a lot on the perimeter. It hadn't changed a whole lot on the field. I think the biggest on-the-field changes are the fact that we don't see complete games anymore. It's the emergence and the dominance of the bullpen. When I broke in 1948, if a pitcher didn't finish a game, it was a disgrace. And he went to the bullpen usually if he had a sore arm or wasn't doing a very good job. There were a few exceptions, but not very many. Now the closer of a team, the ace of the bullpen, is the number one guy, makes more money probably than any other player on the squad. And he's much sought after. And a pitcher who starts a game is not expected now to go more than 5 or 6 innings. The manager will be happy if he gets a good 6 innings so he can go to the bullpen. And we have all kind of specialists. We have the guy comes in the 6th inning. We have another guy who pitches only to left-handers. And we have the semi-closer, and we have the closer. And also, of course, we've got the DH, which is a change. It takes a weak spot out of the lineup in the American League, so the pitcher doesn't have to hit. And we've got the rule makers favoring the offensive side of baseball. They've made the ballparks a lot smaller, and they have made the ball a little bit livelier, and the mound is not as high as it used to be. So most of the rules have been in favor of the pitching and the defense. But the game is intrinsically the same, which makes it unique in the sports world, because all the other sports have changed a lot more than baseball has. In football, you've got the two-platoon system. In basketball, you've got all kind of changes. The tip-off at the beginning of the game doesn't happen anymore. And changes are made off and on by all the other sports except baseball.
Who's the best baseball player you ever watched?
Willie Mays was by far the best player I ever saw, and I was lucky enough to be with the Giants when he made his debut May the 26th, 1951. He got only one hit in the first 26 times at bat, and he went in to see his manager, Leo DeRocher. Willie was crying. He said, I can't make it up here. Leo, you got to send me back to Minneapolis. He'd come up hitting 477 at Minneapolis. And Leo said, just relax, Willie. Don't worry about it. As long as New York's on the front of my uniform, you're going to be my center fielder. Go out there, play your game, have fun, and you'll be a big star. And he was. He made the Hall of Fame.
The best pitcher?
Best pitcher, I think, was probably Warren Spahn. Won more games than any other left-hand pitcher. And he was consistent. He was turned down by Casey Stengel because Casey didn't think he had any guts. And Casey didn't know that he was a hero in the Battle of the Bulge. But he was sent to the minors because he didn't have any guts. And that was Warren Spahn.
When we come back, we'll ask Ernie Harwell about his favorite baseball players. And this is News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Ernie, you've gotten to know thousands of ball players. Who were your favorites?
I think Jackie Robinson was one of my favorites. Eddie Stanky with the Giants was one of my favorites. I loved Al Kaline and got to know him and become a good friend here in Detroit. He's the ultimate Tiger. And the fellows like Frank Tanana is a great favorite of mine. Tommy Brookins, everybody loved Tommy. David Bergman was another one that such a terrific guy, great family man, great citizen. And there's so many guys, Jack, it's hard to leave out so many, but those are just a few that really touch my heart.
Mark the Bird Fidrets comes up and wins over the city.
Well, he did. He was a breath of fresh air in the mid-70s, and he was a terrific guy. He was a sweet guy when he won. He was a sweet guy when he lost. All he wanted to do was to talk to the ball and throw it past the hitters. He led the league in malapropisms. I know one time I was interviewing him, and I asked him about his arm. He said, the arm's not too good. I said, what does Dr. Livingood say about your arm? He said, well, Ernie, Dr. Livingood don't know much about the muscles and arms. He's a skin doctor. He's one of them. Gynecologists.
Norm Cash.
Norman Cash was certainly a favorite of everybody. Had a great sense of humor. He gave me a picture signed to my good friend Ernie Harwell, the second best announcer, the second best announcer in the big leagues. And underneath that, he said the other 25 tied for first place.
There was a special one with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Oh, yeah, Elmer Sexauer was a guy pitched for the Dodgers. He made an impact on me. We had a lady about retired named Miss T. She was a telephone operator, and all about the she wanted to do was talk about how hard she worked and the little time she got off. And one time, this sweet young thing called Ebbets Field. Miss T said, good morning, Ebbets Field. And a young voice on the other end of the line said, do you have a Sexauer there? And Miss T paused for a moment, and she said, Sexauer? Honey, we don't even have a coffee break. So that was Elmer Sexauer, and he pitched for the Dodgers.
Not many people know that you've written 55, 60 songs.
Oh, yeah, well, everybody that writes songs writes a bunch of them, Jack. I probably wrote 200, but I had about 65 recorded. And it was a great avocation for me. I met a lot of wonderful people in music, made some tremendous friends. And I appreciate the musical people because God gives them a special talent, and they bring a lot of enjoyment to a lot of people.
When we come back, we'll talk about your love of 64 years in another month or so. This is News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Ernie Harwell. Ernie, when I called the other day, Lulu answered.
Mm-hmm.
And she said you were out running honeydew errands.
Yeah.
And she said, Jack, in another month, we'll be married 64 years. And I said, Lulu, is he still in training? And without missing a beat, she said, absolutely. Can you talk about Lulu?
Well, Lulu's the best thing ever happened to me. I tell you, she's been a great companion and a sweetheart for all these years, and she's there with me through thick and thin, no matter what happens. I know that I've got her support and her loyalty and her love, and we just get along great. And I have a little joke, you know, somebody says, how do you and Lulu manage to stay married so long? I said, well, we never fight. We just stay up all night and argue. So that's the way we've done it. We've stuck together, and we take up for each other all the time.
The energy that you have is phenomenal. 2 years ago, you signed a 10-year deal with an option for an additional 10 years to be the spokesman for Blue Cross Blue Shield. Why?
Well, I wanted to keep working. I think work is something that keeps you alive and keeps you going and gives you energy. And I told Blue Cross, I'm going to sign this contract with the option, and if I don't fulfill it, I'm going to die trying. So I think they understood that. But I have an outlook about life, Jack, that I think I'm here for a purpose. I think I told you a couple of years ago, I wrote you a little note that I'm here to serve God. And because of his son, Jesus Christ, he lives in me, and I have a purpose. And my aim is to do what they said in Micah, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. I must trust him with all my heart, my soul, and mind, and he directs my journey. I know I'm a sinner, but we can always depend on him to forgive me and let me live life to the fullest.
Ross Perot says it's a funny thing about a lot of people that when they get successful, they quit doing the very thing that made them successful. You've seen that with ball players, and then you saw others that stayed humble, kept practicing. Why is it many quit doing the right things and a few of them keep doing the right thing?
I think some guys just like to rest on their laurels. They figure that they've done all they can do, and they have a vision of maybe playing golf every day and relaxing, and it'll be great. But I lived in Florida quite a few years, and I saw a lot of guys who retired and came down and thought they could fill their life by playing golf, and they discovered later on that it's almost like a 9-to-5 job if you play it every day. So I think it's the attitude mainly, the idea that you want to serve other people and get along with other people and do the best you can.
You meet somebody that you met 2 years ago for one time, and you remember their name. Your recall is unbelievable.
Well, thank you for that. I forget a lot of names now and then, but if a guy's in context, usually I can do fairly well remember him. But I'm just interested in people. I try to find out a little bit about them and who they are and what their needs and wants are and what their ambitions are. And I think God puts us here to serve other people. And, you know, I'm here as a servant, really, and I want to serve other people and do the best I can. And if I happen to have a little success, that's fine, but I don't take it too seriously because I know Lamentations and Ecclesiastes, all those books tell us, everything's vanity. And all these accolades that you get, they're nice to have, and you do appreciate them. But in the long run, they don't mean as much as your relationship with a higher being.
Who do you look up to? Who are your heroes?
Well, my heroes are my dad because, as I told you earlier, he suffered with multiple sclerosis. He was in a wheelchair, but he had a great attitude. He never let anything get him down. My mom was my hero because she made cakes and sandwiches during the Depression and was a real true breadwinner for the family, and all the people that helped me along the way. Branch Rickey was one of my heroes, the guy that signed me to come to the major leagues, the fellow that used the Jackie Robinson and the Noble experiment to break the color line in the major leagues. And all the people like Billy Graham. I dedicated my life to Jesus when I went to a Billy Graham crusade in 1961, and he's one of my heroes. There's so many great thinkers and great writers and people like that I look up to. I've got a lot of heroes.
People say that success is a journey, not a destination.
Well, that's probably right. I don't think I don't think you want to sit down and say, I'm going to be a great success. I tried that in the way, and I didn't get any fulfillment that way, and I had to take the other direction. And whatever you gain, you find out, as I said, it doesn't mean a whole lot. But it is a journey, no question about that. It's day to day, and you have to keep one foot forward and keep on moving. You're going to lose a step now and then and fall back, but you got to look up to that higher power and depend on Him.
What is happiness to you?
Well, happiness is a byproduct. I think joy is something else. I think joy is a permanence that you live because you, in my case, I trust in God and in Jesus, and I have joy because of that. Happiness is something that's sort of a byproduct of that, but it's temporary, whereas joy is a more permanent thing.
What are your dreams for the future?
Well, my dreams is to keep on living as long as God wants me to, and try to be a good husband and a good father and a good citizen and do the best I can and not worry about things, just let God, who has planned my life, carry it through and follow His precepts and His direction.
I talked to Dale Petrosky of the Baseball Hall of Fame yesterday, a good friend. And the first word that came to him when I said Ernie Harwell was humility. How have you kept the humility?
Well, I think it's like that. What was it Churchill said about the guy? Yeah, he's humble because he's got a lot to be humble about. Maybe that's it. No, I don't. You know, I just try to feel like I'm a worker. That's all. And all these things that happen to you, as I say, are very nice, and it's rewarding to hear them. But everybody's got to do his own thing, and I just try to get along, that's all.
You're in great health, great shape. This is one of the things you're talking to us for Blue Cross Blue Shield about. What do you think are the most important things we can do to stay healthy as we get older and older?
Well, I try to exercise every day. I think even walking or exercising a little bit, cutting back on food is very important. I think we all eat too much. The restaurants charge you too much and give you too much. Sandy Koufax used to have the old system where he went to a restaurant and he'd eat half of what they gave him and leave the other half on the plate. Growing up in the Depression, that's awful hard for me to do, you know.
Boy, if he went to one of these steakhouses now, he might only eat a quarter of what they give him.
Right. But I think that's part of it. I think we all overeat. We lack exercise. And I think attitude's a lot, too. You've got to have a positive attitude about things.
A lot of people are not high on the future of Michigan. What are your thoughts?
Well, I hope the future is better than it looks now. Everybody is moaning and groaning about the future, but I think what we have to do is to stop groaning about it and complaining. And we've got so many great people here in business and industry who are smart, intellectual, and they're going to be guided in the right way if they'll all get together and the state and the cities and the counties all pitch in and cooperate with each other and forget their petty differences. And I think we can make a success of Michigan. It's got God's given us great forests and lakes and a beautiful state and a lot of wonderful people here if we can all put it together.
Can you talk a little bit about Alan Trammell?
Alan Trammell has always been one of my favorites, and now he's doing a good job, I think, as managing. There's some criticism of Alan, but that'll always happen when you've got a team that is not over 500, not winning too much. But Alan has done a good job. He's a dedicated, intelligent, personable kind of a guy. You won't find a better friend, and I think he's destined to be an outstanding manager. He's got to have a little time. He's got to have a little breathing room. And I know it's very tough when you're not winning, but he showed that he's got the mettle to come through whether he wins or lose, and he can direct the ball club in the correct fashion.
If you're in front of a child and the child tells you about a dream that they have, a huge dream, what would you say to that child?
I'd say don't give up your dream no matter what you do. Do it with a passion. Put your heart into it. And hard work and a passion and a love for what you do means a lot more than intellect. or brains or whatever.
We're with Ernie Harwell, and this is News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
It's September 30th, 2002, and the last Major League game is just ending for Ernie Harwell. Ernie, would you share with us again how you closed?
Here's the way it went, Jack. I said this. Well, the Tigers have just finished their 2002 season, and I've just finished my baseball broadcasting career, and it's time to say goodbye. But I think goodbyes are sad, and I'd much rather say hello. Hello to a new adventure. I'm not leaving, folks. I'll still be with you living my life in Michigan, my home state, surrounded by family and friends. And rather than goodbye, please allow me to say thank you. Thank you for letting me be part of your family. Thank you for taking me with you to that cottage up north, to the beach, the picnic, your workplace, and your backyard. Thank you for sneaking your transistor under the pillow as you grew up loving the Tigers. Now, I might have been a small part of your life, but you've been a very large part of mine, and it's my privilege and my honor to share with you the greatest game of all. Now, God has a new adventure for me, and I'm ready to move on. So I leave you with a deep sense of appreciation for your long-time loyalty and support. I thank you very much, and God bless all of you.
That was unbelievable. So many people today are having their lives completely changed. They're 50 years old, they lose their job. They watch a son or a daughter go off to college. Huge changes. Changes are great for other people, but it's very hard when the change is for us, Ernie. Can you share with us why you had such a positive attitude as you ended that 55-year career and walked away into the unknown future?
I think you have to do that. I don't think you can get in a rut. I've been in one for a long time, I guess you could say. But I love my job, and I figured that sometimes you have to cut it off and you have to go another direction. And I knew that God was directing me, so I had complete trust in him. I was ready to obey whatever he wanted me to do. And I know there are hard times, and it's easy to advise people. But when you get down to face it, you've just got to go ahead and not give up. So many people give up too early, I think, and they try to find satisfaction in some other way, drugs or alcohol or certain pleasures that are very temporary. And I think we have to get back to the basics that our families taught us in the so-called old days, that the things that are permanent are much more important than these temporary pleasures that we might indulge in. And that's sort of been my attitude, and I just try to do the best I can.
As you went on the road trips, you visited some great cities over and over. Which ones were your favorites?
I love Milwaukee. A lot of people are surprised at that, but Milwaukee was a nice-sized town. And on the road, Jack, the baseball people generally judge a city by the ballpark and the airport or the hotel. We had a great hotel in Milwaukee, the Fista. It was an old hotel that had been renovated. They had a fantastic restaurant, and I'm always interested in restaurants. I love good food, and I had friends in every city and had a lot of good friends in Milwaukee. I felt like the town was about the right size. It was clean. And as far as living there, if I wanted to live there, it's near Chicago. You got a lot of things going for you, yet it's got a small city atmosphere. But I loved every city I went to. There was something good about every city that I enjoyed. And the main thing was I had friends in every town, and I get a few free lunches along the way.
You had some fabulous partners, sidekicks through the years. Can you talk about a few of them?
Well, I had great partners, and you know, people say, who was your favorite? And that's like saying, who's your favorite child? You just can't do that. I started out with George Kell, was a great ball player, Hall of Famer, wonderful player. I learned a lot from George. Then Bob Sheffing, who had managed the Tigers, was my partner for a while. Had a guy named Gene Osborne, who was a straight radio man, had an excellent voice and a good delivery. Then Ray Lane joined me. I enjoyed working with Ray, and Ray's still active. He's a very knowledgeable guy. And then Paul Carey, the guy that worked with me longer than any other man, came along, and he was so great because we got along terrifically together. We had different tastes. He liked to stay up late, and I liked to get up early. He didn't like garlic. I love garlic. He wouldn't go near a restaurant that cooked with garlic, which restricts him a little bit now, I think. But he had a deep voice, and the only problem working with Paul Carey was he made everybody who worked with him sound like a soprano. But I did the best I could. He was knowledgeable, and he was such a loyal person. And he showed me something about life. In 1984, his wife, his first wife, Patty, had a brain tumor, and he was told as we began the World Series that she was going to die. And that was something he had to go through, and saw her die, and then kept on working. He had a great attitude about it, and I really admired Paul.
Before we go, could you please share with us your poem on baseball?
Well, this is a definition I wrote about baseball back in 1955. A lot of things have changed over the years, but I think the spirit of the game is still the same as it was when I wrote it that many years ago. Baseball is a president tossing out the first ball of the season, and a pudgy schoolboy playing catch with his dad on the Mississippi farm. A tall, thin old man waving a scorecard from the corner of his dugout, that's baseball. And so is a big, fat guy with a bulbous nose running home one of his 714 home runs. There's a man in Mobile who remembers that Hannes Wagner hit a triple in Pittsburgh 46 years ago. That's baseball. And so is a scout reporting that a 16-year-old Sandlot pitcher in Cheyenne is a coming Walter Johnson. Baseball is a spirited race of man against man, reflex against reflex. A game of inches. Every skill is measured. Every heroic, every failing is seen and cheered or booed, and then becomes a statistic. In baseball, democracy shines its clearest. The only race that matters is the race of the bag. The creed is a rule book, and color merely something to distinguish one team's uniform from another. Baseball is a rookie, his experience no bigger than the lump in his throat as he begins fulfillment of his dream. It's a veteran, too, a tired old man of 35, hoping that those aching muscles can pull him through another sweltering August and September. Nicknames of baseball, names like Zeke and Pie and Kai Kai and Home Run and Cracker and Dizzy and Dazzy. Baseball is the clear, cool eyes of Rogers Hornsby, the flashing spikes of a Ty Cobb, and an overage pitcher named Rabbit Moranville. Baseball, just a game, as simple as a ball in bat, yet as complex as the American spirit it symbolizes. It's a sport, business, sometimes even religion. The fairy tale of Willie Mays making a brilliant World Series catch and then dashing off to play stickball in the streets with his teenage pals. That's baseball. And so is the husky voice of a Lou Gehrig saying, "I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth." Baseball is cigar smoke, hot roasted peanuts, sporting news, ladies' day, down in front. Take me out to the ball game, the seventh inning stretch, and the star-spangled banner. Baseball is a man named Caponella telling the nation's business leaders, you have to be a man to be a big leaguer, but you have to have a lot of little boy in you, too. This is a game for America, this baseball, a game for boys and for men.
Ernie Highwell, you are a treasure. I want to say for all of us, the listeners, thanks for doing this. Thanks for all you've done for this town for decades. Keep it up. Stay young. Stay healthy. And our guest next Sunday will be David Brandon, the CEO of Domino's Pizza. Until then, thanks for listening. Anything is possible. Make it a great week, Spall.